going to give a few lectures about K-3 surfaces. So what I can tell you is lecture number one is today, and lecture number two is October 21st. There might be some other things happening in this Friday time slot in between. And there will be further lectures later, but I'll be away for the next 2 weeks. So there will be a little bit of a break. And I should say that the long-term goal here is to study some of the recent constructions of manifolds with holonomy G2. Most of you don't know what that's about, but I will just mention that there's a new thing called the Simons collaboration in special holonomy in geometry analysis and physics. And what we're doing in this collaboration is we're studying this problem. We're studying special holonomy, including the K3 case, but also including this case of, sorry, I forgot to write the word G2, also including the case of holonomy G2. So G2 manifolds, those are 7 manifolds with interesting properties. They have the kind of application to physics of those things is that you take what's called M-theory in physics, which is an 11-dimensional theory. You compactify it on such a 7 manifold and you get a 4-dimensional theory. That's all for the future. I'm sort of getting towards that. And the relation to there are two relations to K3 surfaces. One is that there is a relatively recent construction of these manifolds, which uses in an essential way some parts of the geometry of K3 surfaces. And so to understand that in detail, I'd like to explain things about K3 surfaces. And the other is that there's a general strategy, a general hope that lots of G2 manifolds would actually have fibrations by K3 surfaces. Although techniques for building those fibrations aren't quite available, K3 surfaces and families of them are important things to study for this ultimate goal. Anyway, that's what these lectures are kind of aimed at, but for a while they're just going to be about K3 surfaces per se. So before I start on K3 surfaces, I just want to remind people a few facts about elliptic curves, which are an analogous thing that play roles in algebraic geometry, differential geometry, and, well, I can say metric geometry, but the metrics are flat for elliptic curves, so the differential geometry is less interesting. And so if you think about elliptic curves in algebraic geometry, so we could look at a projective algebraic variety. That means it's a subvariety of projective space, some projective space, E, with dimension 1. It should be non-singular. And, you know, in algebraic geometry, we can study these over any fields. We can even study analogous things over rings, which over the function field behaves as an elliptic curve. And in this seminar, we spent some time doing that last year. I want to remind you of the sort of standard thing that you do if you have such a variety. So if there exists a point on the variety, and saying that in algebraic geometry, particularly over a field that's not algebraically closed, can be a restrictive thing. So I might be able to write down algebraic varieties over some field which don't have any solutions whatsoever. There are plenty of examples of those, and so that then this wouldn't apply. But if there exists a point in E, and, okay, so this is over some field, K, and if the characteristic of K is not equal to 2 or 3, then it turns out that E can be described as the vanishing of a particular projective equation, which I'm going to write in this form, where F and G are these coefficients, are elements of the field K. So this is the, if you suppress the Z and go into an affine coordinate chart, sorry, this is in P2 over K. So if you suppress the Z and go into the affine coordinate chart where Z is equal to 1, then you get something like the familiar Weierstrass equation defining an elliptic curve. Virus tries to put a 4 in front of x cubed. I leave the 4 out. That affects things. It affects things more if you're in characteristics 2 or 3, I have to say. But the convention in the applications to physics that I've been making of these things, a long time ago, somebody decided to leave the 4 out, and so we leave the 4 out. So that's kind of the algebraic description of an elliptic curve. Now, there is an interesting way to capture information about elliptic curves over the complex numbers, and that's by means of period intervals. So if k is equal to c, I left out a condition such that the dualizing sheaf of the elliptic curve is isomorphic to the structure sheaf. And another way of saying that is that there exists a nowhere vanishing two-form on E. So this is the sheaf of two-forms. One-form, sorry, it's elliptic curve. I'm getting ahead of myself. So if k is equal to c, there's this very nice thing you could do. You can take the one-form. But by the way, where is the one-form? So in these coordinates, the one-form can be written as dx over y. And that's at least if z is equal to 1. I didn't think through how to homogenize that properly. Can be written as dx over y, or, of course, that's something which has a pole along y equals 0, so there are equivalent forms of it, which are obtained by taking the exterior derivative of the equation and then writing down different homogeneous forms of the same guy. But sort of sticking to that affine piece, I can think of this as just describing an integrand, one form of things that can be integrated over one cycles, and if k is the complex numbers, then, I can imagine taking any one cycle on the underlying manifold and doing this integral, which is a classic elliptic integral, x cubed plus half x plus g, and studying the structure of the algebraic variety E by means of this integral. This is not just one integral. I have to specify a path of integration. In fact, if you have three roots of this cubic, and if I sort of just draw three points which represent the roots of the cubic, then one way of describing paths of integration, well, let's see. So my integrand has a square root, and if I were to encircle one of the roots of the cubic, then the integrand would change sign, and so the representation that I want to make of this integration problem is really on some kind of two-sheeted cover of the complex plane, which is ramified over these three roots of x cubed plus fx plus g, and then for topological reasons also has to ramify at infinity. So if I choose to go around like this, I can do the integral around that contour. That's one possible choice of contour. And then another obvious choice of contour is to go this way. And what I want to point out about this second choice of contour is that it only crosses the first one once. So when I compare what's happening on these two sheets, here I've gone around up onto the other sheet. And so it's only cross. I mean, when I come all the way back, I'm at the same point, but here I'm on two different sheets. So they're meeting here, but they're not meeting at that other crossing point. So that I might call gamma 2. So I can associate to the elliptic curve the data of these two integrals, omega 1, omega 2, which are the integrals over gamma 1 and gamma 2 as I've denoted them. Now, you might object that I've made a sort of arbitrary choice of integration cycles. And in fact, maybe, you know, I sort of lined up the roots in a row, but maybe they weren't so well lined up, or maybe you're going to vary the coefficients and watch the roots permute themselves within
C, and then you would lose track of the particular thing that I drew. So in fact, this is well-defined really only up to some kind of SL2Z action, which is a change of basis for the first homology of the complex elliptic curve. Okay, so the facts about elliptic curves include that this process that I've just described establishes an isomorphism of this integral, I should say, establishes an isomorphism, maybe I'll call it Z. Maybe what I want to call Z is an indefinite integral of this kind, which is going to be it's going to be a number in the complex numbers, but I should mod out by the possible ways of forming closed loops. So I can wander around any path here, maybe from a starting point to an ending point, but then I'll have an ambiguity in my answer depending on whether I also went around some closed loops. So I can account for that by modding C out by integer linear combinations of the two fundamental integrals. These are called periods of the elliptic curve. The two fundamental integrals around those periods. One thing which I didn't check here, but you can verify topologically that these are actually a basis for the first homology. And this actually establishes an isomorphism between the set of complex points of the elliptic curve using algebraic geometry language and this obvious torus. And I guess I should put in a condition that I want is that the imaginary part of the ratio is positive. If that imaginary part were zero, I would not get a lattice that spanned the whole space. If the imaginary part is negative, I can just switch the order of omega 1 and omega 2 and make a positive instead. So by appropriately normalizing things, I might as well make that assumption. And actually, people usually parameterize this by taking the ratio of tau, which is now in the upper half plane, and thinking of that as the kind of fundamental thing. But again, as remarked over there, it's modulo SL2Z. So there's this really pretty connection between the possible projective curves with this property, non-singular with a trivial dualizing sheaf, over the complex numbers, and things that I can describe by means of periods in this way. And there are a number of ways in which this story, this very classical story, has been extended in mathematics. You can go to a billion varieties of higher dimension, which are going to be the analog of this torus. But the direction that is what this lecture is about is to study what are called K3 surfaces. So the last thing I should have said about the differential geometry approach, I already said it just in words, is that there's a flat metric on C mod Z omega 1 plus Z omega 2 inherited from the flat metric C on C, which is just R2, standard Euclidean metric on R2, and that produces a metric. And if you ask for all the flat metrics up to diffeomorphism, on a two-torus, this describes all the flat metrics on a two-torus. So things can be described algebraically, they can be in some intermediate sense described in terms of these periods, and then they turn out to describe all the possible flat metrics on this manifold. Okay, way too much to hope for in general, but for K3 surfaces, we can get pretty close. So the story for each of these aspects is more complicated, but we have a fair amount we can say about it. Okay. Yes?
Is it important for you that this is a group or not?
That what's a group?
The elliptic curve.
Nope, because a K3 surface is not a group.
Well, I understand that. In this case, is it important that it is a group or not?
Important for what?
Well, I'm trying to understand to what extent the group structure there can have.
The only place, I mean, so I made this remark about if there exists a point. So over other fields, there might not exist a point, and then you don't have a group structure, and you can't quite do this. Implicitly, actually, I guess implicitly, I was using that point as the base point for my integration. If you generalize this to a billion varieties, the fact that as a group, even in algebraic geometry, is useful in proving things about it, but in this case, it's not a group, and so I'm de-emphasizing any group properties. Okay, so K3 surfaces, I'll start with a non-singular. I won't forget the word this time. Projective algebraic variety. Maybe we'll call it X. It should have dimension 2. And again, I want the dualizing sheaf to be trivial. So, there exists a nowhere vanishing 2 form. And I'm going to put in one other condition, which is that every one form, global one form on this thing, is identically 0. So that's the other condition that I'm going to put. There are lots of variants of the definition, which are all pretty much equivalent. I think I want to stick with what I've just written down. And so just to get started with the algebraic geometry version, I want to write some examples. And eventually I'll get to number 2, where we talk about periods, and to number 3, where we talk about metrics. And I hope to at least outline some of the key facts in all 3 areas in this first lecture, and then do some more details next time. So examples. So motivated by the description for elliptic curves, I might look at, for examples of the following kind, I'll look for some defining polynomials, f1, f2. I'm going to allow more than one defining polynomial. I want them to intersect transversely to make a so-called complete intersection in projective space. I guess the number of things should be m, since k is the name of the field. So that will be in P2 plus M over the field K. So if I have M equations in a variety of dimension 2 plus M, then they will, if they're meeting transversely, they'll cut out a variety of dimension 2. That's why I'm getting a surface in this way. And in order to figure out that condition about, so that's what X is supposed to be, in order to figure out that condition about the dualizing sheaf, I have to remember, first of all, that the dualizing sheaf of projective space is it's a line bundle, and it has a particular degree, and that degree is minus the dimension of the projective space minus 1. So it's the line bundle whose name is O of minus 3 minus M. And then there's a cool thing called the adjunction formula, which talks about the relationship between the dualizing sheaf or the holomorphic. I keep saying holomorphic. People don't usually use holomorphic unless K is C, so I'm trying to avoid the word until I get to K equals C. When I have a hypersurface contained in a projective variety, there's a relationship between these dualizing sheaves, and it says that the dualizing sheaf of the hypersurface should be the dualizing sheaf of the original guy restricted to the hypersurface, tensored with the normal bundle of the hypersurface inside the larger variety. And if I apply that, normal bundles of hypersurfaces of fixed degree, so I'm going to assume that the degree of Fj is Dj. So normal bundles of hypersurfaces of fixed degree are just the degree of the equation. So if I sort of do this, if I iterate this m times, I end up with the conclusion that the dualizing sheaf of my intersection of hypersurfaces there is the one for projective space. And then I just add in D for each hypersurface of degree D that I intersect along the way. And I want that to be trivial. So this is the condition. And so the condition says that D1 plus D2 up to Dn should be exactly equal to n plus 3. Now, I could allow a degree 1 hypersurface, but that would be a silly thing to do because that would be a projective space of one lower dimension, so there's no point in allowing degree 1 hypersurfaces, so I'll exclude them. I'll take all those to be greater than or equal to 2, and that tells me that this is at most 2m, and then m has to be less than or equal to 3. And it's easy to write down the solutions. If m is equal to 1, then I just have a single equation of degree 4. If m is equal to 2, I have two equations, one of degree 3 and one of degree 2. And if m is equal to 3, I have three equations, all of degree 2. So we've just gotten three distinct algebraic families of, it's not completely obvious that they're distinct. So proving that the general complete intersection of a cubic and a quadric in P4 cannot be also written as a quartic in P3 is, actually maybe we'll see enough within 5 minutes to see why that's true, but these are in fact distinct guys. And they turn out to be part of an infinite series, so the first three terms in an infinite series. So in general, there is an x of degree 2g minus 2. I haven't really told you about the degree of these guys. So the degrees are 4, 6, and 8. Those are just the products of the degrees of the hypersurfaces defining them. And it turns out that for all g, there exists an x of degree 2g minus 2 in pg. So these are the first three instances. For those, for cases where the g in question is bigger than 3, it turns out... Sorry, I don't know what G is here.
Sorry, Dave, can I?
Yes.
Where is the 2m less than the sum of the degrees?
That's because I'm assuming that each degree is at least 2.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry, I got confused about my G. I was in P2 plus m, and that's G. So the genus would be 3, 4, and 5. So if I get to genus 6 or more, then I can still do this, but I can't do it just by intersecting hypersurfaces. The description in terms of algebraic geometry is more complicated. And the reason that the letter G is here and I use the word genus is that if I intersect the K3 surface with a hyperplane in the projective space, I get a Riemann surface algebraic curve whose genus is G. So for every curve of genus G, there's a family of these things in the appropriate projective space, PG. So it's sort of a fun exercise, which I won't do today, to show that the dimension of the set of all x's of degree 2G minus 2 in PG of this kind is 19. And that's independent of G. So we have this large number of 19-dimensional families of these K3 surfaces constructed algebraically. Let's see. This is G equals 3, so maybe there's one other case, which is kind of the n equals 0 or G equals 2 analog. And it's worth writing down because it shows up sometimes. And that is, I could also take a 2-to-1 cover of P2. Okay, so in all of these cases, to get these statements to all be true, I should take either characteristic k is 0 or characteristic k is sufficiently large. Small characteristics can get in the way of some of these statements. And here, I'm certainly going to need characteristic not equal to 2. I can take a 2-to-1 cover of P2K branched on a plane sextic. Plane curve of degree 6. So that would look like y squared. Y is not a good letter. That would look like t squared is, you know, x to the 6 plus y to the 6 plus z to the 6, other terms, whatever terms we might have, where this is a homogeneous polynomial of degree 6 in P2. Okay, so this is how I get algebraic examples of these things. I also want to talk about example 2, which is slightly more complicated. These were examples 1, maybe. So example 2, I'm going to mimic the description I had of elliptic curves a minute ago, but with C2 instead of C. So if I simply were to take C2 mod, and I won't specify so precisely which lattice I'm looking at, but I want to choose 4 vectors in C2, which would span it over R and therefore give me an actual torus as the quotient. So this is not an example of a K3 surface because of the condition that I put that there aren't any one-forms, which means holomorphic one-forms in complex analysis. And you can see one-forms here quite easily. They come from complex lines inside of the complex surface, C2. But if instead I extend the quotient by plus or minus 1, that still has the property that the 2-form is preserved. So where did the 2-form come from? It came from dz1 went to dz2, and if I act on both complex coordinates by minus 1, the 2-form is preserved, whereas each individual 1-form is sent to minus itself, so the 1-forms die. This is something like a singular K3 surface. I mean, I defined them to be non-singular, so it's kind of cheating to now call them singular. It's a singular K3 surface because there are 16 singularities located at the half lattice points in this lattice, which locally take the form C2 mod this plus or minus 1. So those are conical singularities. They're relatively easy to describe. And in algebraic geometry, so they have lots of names. Sometimes they're called A1 singularities. And in algebraic geometry, there's a very nice procedure which consists of taking this cone and doing what's known as blowing up in algebraic geometry. And that blow up replaces the central point of the cone with a 2-sphere. And that 2-sphere is a curve, C alpha, with property, among other properties, it has self-intersection, so it's product with itself if I take that curve and, what's obvious is that a curve defines a homology class, if you're doing the topology. I want to think of it as dually defining a cohomology class, and then taking the cup product of that cohomology class with itself, with the normalization I'm using, turns out to be value minus 2. So if I do that process, maybe I'll just have a little notation for it. I'm going to blow up at 16 points C2 mod Z4 semidirect plus or minus 1. I get what's called a Coomer surface. And because locally, the local 2-form here is preserved by the plus or minus 1, if you make a local study of this blow-up process, you discover that that property continues to hold even after doing the blow-ups. So this turns out to be an example of a K3 surface. So the modern study of K3 surfaces started in the mid-1950s with the observation that somebody made. Gosh, I should have looked this up because I can't quite remember who made the observation. An observation that was made, which was that this Coomer surface had the same, at least Betty numbers, and probably other parts of the topology were known as well, as a quartic hypersurface in P3. And the question was asked, why? Why would it come out to have the same Betty numbers? In fact, the Betty numbers are Betty numbers are a dimension of homology groups, right? So it's a compact, and I'm calling it a surface because it's a surface in algebraic geometry, but if I'm over the complex numbers, then the underlying manifold is a four-manifold. So I'm talking about the numerical invariance of a four-manifold, and as I'll review in a few minutes, the first and third Betty numbers vanish because there weren't any holomorphic one-forms by assumption, and the second Betty number turns out to be 22. So that's a sort of strange number to encounter. Actually, I can get it pretty easily from here. You can see 6 2 cycles on the complex 2 torus. And then I added 16 cycles, so I got 22 total cycles. So that one's not so hard. A little trickier is to compute the Betty numbers of the quartic in P3, but that also came out to be 22. And I mean, the paper that I know from the mid-50s just mentions those cases, but I'm sure at the same time anybody could have made calculations for at least the first two of those, which are also very doable using the complete intersection technology, and again come out with 22. So this was this sort of started a whole theme of investigation. Maybe these particular surfaces could be studied using periods, which were so effective for abelian for elliptic curves and abelian varieties. And a fair amount of that work was done in the late 1950s by André Vey. And our only record of it is a grant report that Vey had to write. So he had to write a report on an Air Force contract. And it's pretty clear from the tone of this report that he really detested having to write this report. You know, why should he have to tell the Air Force what he's doing is roughly what's being expressed, but he does tell them what he's doing, and what he's doing is sort of outlining the story of period integrals and how they might be used to characterize these guys. And then that theme was taken up by a number of people. So this class of surfaces had been studied in algebraic geometry quite a bit in the early, say, the first half of the 20th century, but now that the focus was kind of shifting to complex manifolds, Kähler manifolds, and a little more analytic techniques, and I don't think that the study of periods on K3 surfaces had been done, at least not certainly not systematically, before this work of Vey that I'm discussing. Okay, so number two is going to be that these, over the complex numbers, X is a compact complex surface. And the importance of figuring out which definitions are being used in the literature is important if you're looking back at the old stuff. There's a beautiful theorem of Su proved in the 1970s. And the theorem is every K3 is Kähler. So the original definitions studied complex surfaces without the assumption that there was that they were Kähler, but I'm actually going to put Kähler into my definition. So for me, a complex K3 surface automatically is Kähler, and what Su's theorem tells us is that you could weaken that definition a little bit, and it still comes out to be Kähler. So I'm going to let X be a Kähler surface.
What's the definition of K3 then? I'm sorry, you're saying the K3 surface?
Yeah, so there were various definitions used in the 60s. I think the one that Su was using was simply connected, global, nowhere vanishing holomorphic two-form, and compact complex. I think that those were his only hypotheses. For me, it's convenient to sort of drag in Kähler from the beginning. So in complex geometry, we can look at Kähler surfaces. So what's a Kähler surface? So this is a complex surface equipped with a certain kind of metric. So implicitly, I'm going to be doing Riemannian geometry on these guys. But in Kähler geometry, we hardly ever talk about the Riemann tensor. What we want is a Riemannian metric on this complex manifold, which is Hermitian. So we want to do Riemannian geometry of Hermitian metrics. So that means that written in terms of complex coordinates, it's pretty standard to use a notation like this, you would have had a metric tensor in Riemannian geometry, and you'll simply write that metric tensor with respect to holomorphic and anti-holomorphic coordinates. So here we risk getting confused about i's and so on. Z alpha is x alpha plus I, and if you're being really careful, you'll write I that way because you might want to use I as an index someday. Z alpha will be this, and but then this expression is real if the matrix itself is Hermitian. So I will allow complex values here, but I insist that the overall G alpha beta bar matrix be Hermitian, and then that makes the underlying two-form symmetric differential real. There's a very cool thing you can do with a Hermitian matrix. You can multiply it by I, although for reasons of making certain things come out nice, we typically write it by multiply by I over 2 pi. But anyway, you can multiply it by I, and then it becomes a skew Hermitian matrix. So skew Hermitian matrix means I should build a differential form out of it, which is anti-symmetric rather than symmetric. And this is a standard two-form called the Kähler form of the Hermitian metric on a complex manifold. Actually, you can do it for an almost complex manifold. And the definition of Kähler means that this differential form is closed. Okay, there are a bunch of physicists in the room, and this is the moment to mention that N equal 1 supersymmetric theories in four dimensions have scalars which take values in a Kähler manifold. And in fact, one of the key properties of being Kähler is that locally you can write the Kähler form. Omega can be written as, again, I'll put an I over 2 pi, dd bar log of a function, capital K. And this function in the physics literature is known as the Kähler potential. It's not uniquely defined. It's only defined locally. You can change it from local patch to local patch by adding the norm of a complex, the norm of a holomorphic function to it. Physicists who study supersymmetric theories will recognize the great utility of a formula like that, because in supersymmetric theories you have to take terms that you would like putting a metric in some integrand, but then writing them in terms of writing that integrand as an integrand also over some fermionic variables, and doing the fermionic integrals tends to take some derivatives of the expressions in the integrand. So you would like to be doing something that involved the integral of omega. If you can write omega as two derivatives of something, then you can put it into a nice supersymmetric term, which involves some integration over odd variables. Okay, so that's just a remark. That's sort of how that story gets into N equal 1 supersymmetric physical theory. Anyway, I have a Kähler surface. Surface just means the complex dimension is 2. And again, I want to assume that there exists a nowhere vanishing holomorphic 2 form on this guy. And I'm also going to assume that every holomorphic 1 form, these are global statements, holomorphic 1 form is identically 0. So there aren't any holomorphic 1 forms, but there is a nowhere vanishing holomorphic 2 form. Let's see. So among the interesting features of Kähler manifolds, if I take the kth cohomology of the Taylor manifold with complex coefficients. This is the one part of the Hodge theory. It has a decomposition into what are called PQ parts of the cohomology. So this people often describe as Durham cohomology. They look at exterior differentiation on differential forms and form Kernelsmann images for that story. You could do a similar thing on differential forms whose PQ type has been fixed. The PQ type is how many DZs and how many DZ bars there are in the form. And you can use the D bar operator. Implicitly, I had it here that this D and D bar operator are the natural things you get by decomposing exterior differentiation into type. And the condition to be holomorphic, by the way, the Cauchy-Riemann equations in complex analysis say the D bar of a function is equal to zero. If you unpack that, it turns out to be the Cauchy-Riemann equations. Okay, so here I take PQ of X with respect to the D bar cohomology, and there's this nice decomposition, and it's also true that HPQ of X is canonically HQP complex conjugate. So this is what leads to my conclusion, well, about this much of the Betti numbers for such a surface. Namely, it's a connected four-manifold. So B0, connected compact four-manifold. So B0 and B4 both have to be 1. Then B1, the dimension of H1, is the sum of the dimensions of H10 and H01. But those are the same. And moreover, I've assumed that H10, the dimension of the holomorphic one forms, is 0. So the first Betti number and by Poincaré duality, the third Betti number, have to vanish, and that just leaves the second. Okay, I'm not going to really review much of Kähler geometry, but I'm going to tell you things like I just did, facts about Kähler manifolds. So, so other facts in this setting include the following statement. So I've written a Kähler form, omega, and I didn't want to call the Kähler form little omega. Well, I'm running the risk of confusion between my Kähler form little omega and my dualizing sheaf that I had a few minutes ago. So the dualizing sheaf of X being trivial is equivalent to the existence of a global section of H20. So an omega living inside this H20 cohomology. So it's a 2-0 form. It's a holomorphic 2-0 form. And it has no zeros. So I immediately conclude that the second Betti number is 1 plus H11 plus 1. Okay, the H20 and by that duality over there, H02 are both equal to 1. There is a special class in the integer cohomology of any actually complex manifold. So I'm taking the holomorphic tangent bundle, and the holomorphic tangent bundle is some complex bundle over the space, and every complex bundle has what's called a first turn class. And the zeros of the first turn class, okay. A little more generally, if I didn't have trivial dualizing sheaf, but just looked at a holomorphic 2-form and asked what its zeros were, then the zero set of the holomorphic 2 form in general would have a class which was the same as the first term class of the holomorphic tangent puppet. That's the statement I'm trying to get at. And in particular, if this is trivial, which it is, then the self-intersection of that class, its self-cut product, this is just briefly called C1, C1 squared has to be equal to 0. Okay, so one of the key things here is a sort of consequence of one of the Riemann-Roch theorems. It comes from the Herzebruch-Riemann-Roch theorem. And it says that if you take the square of the first Turing class, for any complex surface, if you take the square of the first Turing class plus the second Turing class, you get 12 times 1 minus H10 plus H20. So that's a general fact about complex surfaces. It's the sort of thing that you prove using Herzebruch-Riemann-Roch, or in even fancier terms, the Tia-Singer index theorems. The analogous statement in complex algebraic geometry was known to the Italian school of algebraic geometry in the first half of the 20th century, with slightly different definitions of the terms. For us, C2 turns out to be the Euler characteristic of X, and I've just verified, or claimed, that C1 squared was equal to 0. So I'm going to get to 22. I'm going to actually prove that now, but I mean, assuming these other things. So what do I have? I have no holomorphic 1 forms. I have a single holomorphic 2 form, so that's 24. And so that's the order characteristic of the underlying 4 manifold. Because B1 and B3 are 0, and B0 and B4 are 1, that's 2 plus the second Betti number. So that tells me that the second Betti number is 24. And another thing I learned from this little calculation is that, in fact, the number of 1-1 forms, second Betti number is 22, number of 1-1 forms is 20. Okay, the next thing along the Herzebruch-Riemann-Roch lines, and it really is part of the Kähler story, is the signature of the intersection form on H2. And that signature is always 1 plus H20, comma, H11 minus 1. Sorry, I've been using this notation without ever saying what it was. My lowercase h is the dimension of my Hodge group, capital HPQ. So that's true in general, and 2H20, excuse me. That's true in general, and so what's true for these guys is that I end up with the signature of the intersection form being 3, 19. Okay, so I'm sort of inching my way towards a topological understanding of K3 surfaces, thought of as 4 manifolds. And from those relatively minimal defining assumptions, together with some machinery from Kähler geometry and the index theorem, I end up with a sort of nice conclusion. So there's a cup product pairing on the second cohomology. That's always true for a 4 manifold into the integers. And what we've just decided is that if you work over R, this is, which is symmetric, by the way, it's a property of dimension. If you work over R, this has signature 319. And there's another topological fact, has to do with Stiefel-Whitney classes, which says that this is an even pairing. So it says that if you have a class E, E paired with itself is an even integer for all E in H2 X. Okay, so Vey was working hard on understanding these things in the late 50s, and at a certain point, he was having lunch with Don Spencer, and at the Institute for Advanced Study, I heard this story from Spencer. They were having lunch and they were talking about these things and they were trying to figure out some kind of name to give them because there was no name in the literature associated with these particular class of surfaces. And the Himalayan peak named K2 had recently been scaled, and they thought that understanding these surfaces was almost as hard as climbing K2, so why didn't they call them K3 surfaces? And they thought of three people's names to name them after, three people named, whose names start with K, as a sort of excuse. So Kaler and Coomer, you already heard of. When Spencer told me the story, he initially remembered that the third one was a guy named Knazer, but actually he then called up Vey, who corrected him and said the third one was Kadaira, who was also starting to work on these things. So there's a little bit of debate about exactly who the three Ks are, but you won't find anybody using this. These are the three that are always in literature. But Knazer is actually the one responsible for the statement that this amount of information uniquely specifies a Z module of rank 22 with an intersection pairing on it up to isomorphism. So just knowing that the signature is 3,19 and that all of the elements have even self-product under this pairing tells you that H2 of XZ is isomorphic preserving the pairing to, first of all, you have to have the indefinite part, so I'm going to write that part this way. And then you have to have a negative definite lattice of signature 16. And just to follow everybody's conventions, I'm going to call those that minus E8 plus minus E8. So there's a serious problem with conventions here. The problem is that the Lee theorists got their sign wrong. Okay, Lee theorists should have had the other sign, and then it would have agreed with algebraic geometry so much more nicely. And I will argue that the orientation of the four-manifold doesn't let me change the sign in algebraic geometry. It's the Lee theorists who should have had the other sign. Okay, but so this is actually the root lattice of E8. Showing up there. I can draw you the intersection matrix, or for those who know how to read it off of a Dynkin diagram, I remind you that the Dynkin diagram for E8 looks like this. That's the data that tells me what it is. And when you write a Cartan matrix for the root lattice, you end up putting minus 2s on the diagonal you end up putting 2s on the diagonal and minus 1s off diagonal, but what I want to do in my topological intersection pairing is the opposite. I want 2s on the diagonal and minus 1s off the diagonal. Okay, so the corresponding thing for elliptic curves, by the way, there I would have been looking at a skew symmetric pairing, again because of the dimension, into the integers. These are just rank 2, and that's the smallest place you can have a skew symmetric pairing. Oh, sorry, there's one other condition, obviously, that I forgot to mention, which is that the determinant of this pairing is equal to 1, plus or minus 1. And that just follows from Poincaré duality. So here again, you would have to have something like the determinant is plus or minus 1. And that's enough to tell you that the skew pairing in an appropriate basis has this kind of matrix. So that's what got us going with where we were going to calculate periods for elliptic curves. And now, to do periods for K3 surfaces, we're going to deal with this rank 22 lattice, so we have to choose, in principle, a basis of 22 two-cycles for the K3 surface, and take all 22 of those numbers where we would integrate the holomorphic two-form over the two-cycles to get some kind of point that corresponds to the period point that label the upper half plane in the elliptic curve case. Okay, I'm not going to get as far as I hoped today. For those who are new, I do tend to go past 5 in this seminar, but I'm not going to go forever. So I'll tell you a few more things and then wrap it up for today. So the basic story of the periods is going to be choose a basis, gamma 1 up to gamma 22, of, and I'll switch to H lower 2, Poincaré duality identifies the two guys, and then to X, I want to assign a point which consists of the integral of my holomorphic 2 form, that was capital omega, over each of these two cycles. Those are all numbers. And I'll put that into a complex projective space of dimension 21. The reason why I get a well-defined projective point is that the holomorphic 2 form is only well-defined up to a scalar multiple, right? So I have if I have two holomorphic 2 forms and I take their ratio, I get a function which is well-defined everywhere, so it has to be constant on this compact guy. Holomorphic function has to be constant. So that means that the only thing I can do is scaling, and the sort of invariant information is that P21. There is a property of the corresponding vector, which is that if you look at the self-intersection of that vector with respect to the inner product, it's zero. That's the kind of analog of saying that omega, that was 2,0 and 2,0, so that would be type 4,0, which isn't possible on a complex surface. And V bar has to be positive. So that's omega wedge omega bar. So I'm actually going to get cut down to 20 complex dimensions by this equation, and then to an open subset by that equation. So the image of this guy is an open subset inside of the vanishing locus of the intersection form. That's a quadric hypersurface inside P21C. And in particular, it has complex dimension 20. So I told you, and I thought I might have time to show you why today, that all of those algebraic families that we found had complex dimension 19. A dimension in algebraic geometry, 19, and if you specialize to the ground field being the complex numbers, it would be complex dimension 19. And here I found, using this approach, a family that has complex dimension 20. So this was a big surprise in the work of Kodaira and Spencer in the late 1950s, so I did an undergraduate thesis with Spencer, which is why I got all these stories. But anyway, the surprise is published in their work because they were studying, for example, arbitrary hypersurfaces in arbitrary projective spaces and making calculations about how many parameters such a hypersurface should depend on. And as is well known, if you look at curves in P2, the number of parameters that the curve depends on is determined by the genus. It's actually 3g minus 3, whereas nowhere near that number of parameters is determined by the embedding into P2. So for P2, it doesn't match up, and there's actually several good explanations for why it wouldn't. But aside from curves in P2, every other case of a hypersurface in a projective space has its intrinsic number of parameters equal to the number of deformations within the projective space, except for K3 surfaces, except for quartics in P3. And if you extend to complete intersections, again, they show up as the counterexample to such a statement for complete intersections. And what it means, in fact, you could do the deformation theory just in the category of algebraic geometry, and you discover that the answer is 19. So what it means is that these are quite interesting surfaces, which may start life as algebraic varieties. Start life. Okay. There are K3 surfaces which are algebraic varieties, and you might have thought that if you had an algebraic variety and you did its deformations as a complex manifold or a Kähler manifold, you would still have an algebraic variety, but no, for K3 surfaces that's false, and you can kind of get out in one direction, precisely one direction. So just to kind of finish my little outline, let me quickly, so we'll have to talk lots more about periods and moduli and lots of fun things, and actually, oh, yeah, so while I'm at it, I should mention that you can put, you can find a way to map the matrix which has 16, this is a 16 by 16 diagonal matrix with minus 2. That should be the matrix describing the intersections of those 16 curves I generated in the Coomer construction. I can find a way to map that into my H2XZ. Obviously, it has to work. But there's a kernel to that mapping. And it turns out that that kernel is Z2 to... I hope I remember this correctly. Z2 to the fifth. 16 minus 10 is 6. Yes, Z2 to the fifth. So there have to be non-obvious relations among those blow-up curves that you get from the Coomer construction, among their homology classes, as you map into H2XZ. But that also, that setup agrees with what I've been telling you about the lattice, in the sense that, so this had signature 319, here I have signature 016, so it's almost injective, it only has a finite kernel. And so what's left over is a 3,3, and it's easy to verify that that's the signature that you get for the intersection pairing on the complex 2 torus, the guy before we mounted out by the plus or minus 1. So this whole setup is sort of compatible with that that example as well. Okay, so let me quickly say some of the key facts about the metric behavior. So the utility of K3 surfaces is really based on Yau's proof of the Calabi conjecture. Calabi conjectured and Yau proved. If you're given X and a Kähler metric omega, there exists a unique Kähler metric omega prime such that if you calculate the Ricci tensor for omega prime, it's zero, identically zero, and the Kähler class of omega prime is the same as the Kähler class of omega in H2 Dirac. So if you've specified sort of the fundamental topological information about the metric that you care about, namely the Dirac class of its Kähler form, then you can modify uniquely to find a Ricci flat metric in that particular class. So from the point of view of, and such metrics have special holonomy, I should say. So the holonomy, well, I'm not going to define that today, but the holonomy of omega prime is actually SU2 sitting inside of SO4. So a generic Riemannian four manifold has holonomy SU4, and this Ricci flat Kähler condition makes the holonomy SU2. So this looks like maybe it's just a refinement. Nobody maybe should care about it. It turns out that there are several possible proofs of some of the key facts about the periods. So one of the things which I told you implicitly was that the tau up to SL2Z determined the elliptic curve. And there are similar statements here. They're known as Torelli-type theorems. And there are very nice proofs of Torelli-type theorems based on the existence of these metrics. So that's one possible utility. But there's a really interesting property, which is that the underlying Riemannian metric in any of these cases, in the Ricci flat case, has an entire S2 of compatible complex structures. So over here, I was sort of describing the possible complex structures. I actually was not paying attention to the metric other than to assume that at least one such metric exists. And I got a 20-parameter family of complex structures. And if you think a little bit about where the Kähler classes can be, they can be in real 20-parameter family of H11 classes. And actually, the volume is not going to count in the parameter count I'm doing, so I can sort of subtract one from the volume, and that gives me 59 real dimensions. But what this is saying is that that's overcounting metrics, and the dimension of the space of metrics volume one metrics is, as I just said, so I'm counting real dimension now, so it's 40 for the complex structures, plus 20 for the 1-1 form, minus 1 for the volume, and then minus 2 for this fact that there's a compatible an S2 of compatible complex structures for each fixed metric, so that adds up to 57. Well, there's another version, a version that's sort of well adapted to the differential geometry of the period story. And for that version, I take a GIJ, which is an SU2 holonomy metric, on the underlying manifold, an underlying K3 4 manifold. And to it, I assign a three-dimensional subspace. The three-dimensional subspace is the set of all alpha in H2 XR. I really want harmonic representatives, so I didn't introduce that, sorry. But such that alpha is harmonic, and the hot star of alpha is alpha. Well, the signature theorem tells me the dimension of that space. That's a space of dimension 3. And it's sitting inside of all of H2XR, which is a space of dimension 22. So I determine in this way an oriented, as it turns out, three-plane inside of this space, positive three-plane inside this space of signature 322, but anyway, its dimension is 319, its dimension is 22, and choosing a plane like that means that I should construct it as a real Grassmannian. You don't really need a basis for the 3 or for the complementary 19 in order to specify the 3 plane, and that's dimension 57. So in algebraic geometry, we kind of look at the complex structures, we map them into this space of complex dimension 20. In differential geometry, the natural thing to do is to look at the self-dual harmonic harmonic 2 forms for each underlying Ricci-flat metric on this manifold and get a point in O322. So that space, this space and that space, are the analogs of the upper half plane that I had for my elliptic curve story, and then I have to mod out by some group, and here it turns out that the natural group, it's easier to say here, the natural group to mod out by, excuse me, is the real orthogonal group, let me just call it the orthogonal group of H2XE, except it's index 2 inside the orthogonal group of H2XE. There's a little, funny little invariant which has to be taken into account. So last remark has to do a little bit with that invariant. So you might think this is kind of hopeless. I was trying to integrate over all the cycles. In fact, somebody wrote down an explicit handle-body decomposition of the K3-4 manifold. So if you really want to understand how to do these integrals, you have enough data about the topology that you could do that. I don't think anybody ever has, but it could be done. But that handle-body decomposition actually allowed sadly I've forgotten his name at the moment, but it allowed two independent authors to actually construct non-trivial diffeomorphisms of the K3 manifold, and they were able to construct as non-trivial diffeomorphism an index 2 subgroup of the orthogonal group of the second cohomology. And that was a little puzzling until Donaldson came along and constructed an invariant of 4 manifolds, which turned out to imply that you had to be in that index 2 subgroup. I mean, there was no diffeomorphism outside that index 2 subgroup. So Donaldson's invariant implies that you are restricted to index 2, and this explicit topological construction of these guys, whose names I will remember, you know, in 10 minutes, right? Let you go the other way, and conclude that that's the correct group. Okay, so I didn't really get to much of the applications to physics. In physics, you're going to use this to compactify various string and M-theory things and so on, and those metrics are important. But what we really need to explore more are properties of these classifying spaces, how you identify K3s with certain kinds of properties, like extra automorphisms or lots of line bundles, because we will need those in the constructions for G2 spaces that I'm going to discuss later on. I'll stop there for today.
Any questions? You mentioned the complete intersections that they give the full information.
So the complete intersections give the full algebraic deformations of those K3s, which depend on 19 parameters, but then there's another complex deformation, which is transverse to those, which doesn't live in algebraic geometry. They're not schemes. In fact, they have the generic point in the complex moduli space. There are no non-constant holomorphic functions on that. Other questions? Yeah.
You described these different genera of K3 surfaces. Are those all the algebraic K3 surfaces?
Yes. So from this point of view, it turns out that hyperplane class that I mentioned, so that was some curve that was described on the K3 surface in some algebraic embedding, that's a class in here which is cannot be divided by an integer and which has the property that its self-intersection is 2g minus 2. And it turns out that all such classes are conjugate under this group. So you can sort of do with one of them, and the existence of that class is what you need to embed into PG. So some K3 surfaces will have more classes, some algebraic K3 surfaces will have a large number of classes, and so a large number of different embeddings into projective spaces, but every K3 is counted at least once by that construction. Every algebraic K3 is counted at least once. Okay, so to be continued on the 21st.